ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm Carrington Clark.
And I'm Alan Kohler.
In 2026, business big and small is moving at a rapid pace. And ABC Business Daily is here to help you cut through the noise and spin, Monday to Thursday.
And on Friday, I sit down with business leaders, founders, creators, change makers, and those in the know to ask them how they see the world, because that's business.
All in the ABC Business Daily feed on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Artificial intelligence. It's here to stay, and it isn't just about our future. Today on Big Ideas, meet a thinker who argues AI is also about the past, that AI is in fact history because it's built using everything that came before.
Majority of the data for AI is from your past. The photos that you take, all the navigation routes that you've taken, all the times you spelt the same word wrong over and over and over again and been politely corrected, every traffic light that you've clicked on, every book that you've bought, every cookie that you've accepted without the sweet, sweet taste of choc chip, the content you've generated, the kitten videos you've watched, the songs you've listened to, and, of course, the movies that you've streamed. AI is making recommendations about the future on the basis of your past.
But what will the future of our past look like with AI as a guide, hey? Welcome to Big Thinkers at the Best Live Events. This is Big Ideas on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen. I'm Natasha Mitchell. And scraping the internet today is philosopher and historian Marnie Hughes Warrington. Now, she's the Bradley Distinguished Professor at the University of Adelaide, researching how machines write histories. And can we call AI an artificial historian, maybe? She's co-edited the books History from Loss and The Routledge Companion to History and the Moving Image. She's co-secretary general of the International Commission for the History and Theory of History. And on Big Ideas, she's delivering this annual lecture for the History Council of Victoria with the title, Can I Help You? Recognising and Improving Artificial Intelligence as History Maker. Take it away, Marnie.
If you're anything like me, you probably get a lot of offers of help every single day. Offers to write something or make something, perhaps even animate a film, which you could do, to summarise your own writing because it looks like it's quite complex and maybe it could be shorter and simpler. Offers to make your PowerPoint presentation be about yoga and relaxation rather than the topic of the 23rd history lecture for the History Council of Victoria. Movies that you might want to watch, music that you might want to listen to, all under your name. And of course, and my favourite, a curation of your own photographs brought back to you with country and Western music. And apart from the people in my life, the most common theme of my slideshows curated for me is waterfalls through the ages. I recommend it. They're great movies. Now, look, if you're like me, you're probably slightly annoyed by some of these offers. You think, goodness, you know my name, you're bugging me every day. I don't really want to rate the delivery of the parcel that I received today. I appreciate the offer, but I'm done here. I recognise, though, that my annoyance is not the way in which people talk about artificial intelligence and not how most people experience it. And this is not going to be a track-of-the-mill lecture, just to let you know. It's going to be a little different. For some people, AI is anxiety-generating. They feel that AI has not been explained to them in a way that they understand or that they feel a part of. They don't get how it works, and they feel that AI has come for their job, it's come for their ideas, it's come for meaningful work, and it's come for both their planetary future and the planetary future of the children. And so people do feel anxious of AI. And that anxiety is often described in terms of like the people who watched the first movie, who saw a train coming to them, the Lumiere brothers, and flee from the screen. Terrified, flinching, that's the description. And that's how AI is described for some people. For other people, though, it's just, yeah, okay. It's like that moment when the plane lands and they say you can switch off airplane mode. And there's a moment of silence as everyone bows their head, turns off airplane mode, and there's a massive downloading that goes on. Maybe it's like that too. The truth is actually neither of those things, and I'm going to argue that tonight through history. Now, I do have to kind of define what artificial intelligence is, and then you'll think it's going to be a very short lecture. It's a cluster of technologies often described of and for the future. And Toby Walsh has described that really well. It's a great definition. So an offer of help from AI is an offer of help about what we might do, what I might write, what I might watch, what I might sing, what I might do, what I might make. If that's the case, then the relationship between history and AI is actually a very simple one. It's that AI has a history. And often when I tell people when I work on AI, they say, oh, you're writing its history. And I go, historians can do more than that. But that's often the way in which our relationship with AI is described. We're going to write the history of how other people are doing it. But since 2017 or 18 or 19 or 20, depending on when you caught hold of generative AI, we also know now that AI makes histories. It doesn't matter whether you think they're good or not, right? It makes histories. So you can ask generative AI to generate a history and it will plausibly produce something. You might not think it's brilliant, but it can actually do that. And people think actually what it does produce is pretty good. There was a paper earlier this year by Microsoft arguing that users of generative AI had the highest satisfaction with the history outputs that were produced. Ergo, historians are now extinct. That's what the press said. Microsoft didn't say that, but that's what some people leapt to, that there's a satisfaction with Gen AI, therefore historians are no longer needed. So that's the second lens. But I'm going to argue something a little bit more than that, and that's this, that actually there's a third view on AI, and this is the one that people don't catch. AI has been since the mid-1980s an historical field. And this is the idea I'm going to take you on a journey with tonight. But we're going to go back to that first circle and the idea of AI having a history, because that's the departure point for this story. This is a story which has a remarkable level of agreement. If you've read a lot of histories of AI, they tend to agree on a lot of things, which if you're an historian like me is really quite surprising. I'm used to historians not agreeing on very much at all, pretty much. So when I started reading histories of AI, I was genuinely surprised that people agreed on the key turning points, on the key points, and thought it's not that they're copying one another, it's just that they agree on these key things. And one of the things they agree on is that there was an early phase of AI in which people wrote instructions for computers and those computers executed those commands. It's often called symbolic AI, early AI, pre-1980s AI. And so you'll find this view communicated in a range of books from Pasquinelli's Social History of AI, McCordock's lovely History of AI, which includes a lot of oral histories, right through to Toby Walsh's fantastic Shortest History of AI. He's an Australian researcher. So there's a bunch of histories of AI which remarkably agree that there's this kind of early take on AI. You write instructions and then you execute them. The form of those instructions could come in different ways. The instructions could be written in symbolic logic. They could be written in code, or they could be written in what's called natural language, what you and I would call everyday language. Now, as a blast from the past, when I was a kid, computers were instructed with punch cards. So little holes were punched in cards to instruct computers about what to do. And my family was such, we had such an association with the IBM at my dad's work that we got all the old punch cards at home. And by the time I got to school, I actually didn't realise that paper didn't come without holes in it. I was so used to drawing on the back of punch cards, I didn't realise paper could be white. And it was just had no holes. And I would remember saying to my first school teacher, what am I going to do? I used to join the dots between the holes and make pictures. And she just said, make some holes in the paper, you'll be fine. It was great educational advice, and I'd like to thank her for that advice too today. Make your own way was what she was saying. But you can also give instructions in natural language, and if you ask generative AI for instructions on a maker history, it will do that. It will give you a set of instructions, and I'll come back to those instructions in just a moment. So that's the way people talked about AI pre-1980s, instructing, executing. Then there's a turning point, and this is argued across all of these histories, that around the mid-1980s, AI takes a turn, and it becomes a discipline of learning. And learning is the emphasis in all of these histories. It shifts away from telling to learning, which is really important. And it's argued that arguably AI exits a series of winters. They called winters AI winters in the mid-1980s, and those winters were downturns in interest and in funding. It changes tack and it really begins to accelerate. It's not to say that there haven't been bumps along the way, but that's really the argument, is that there's this fundamental shift, and that shift is what enables the amazing technologies that you and I experience today. Now, as a good historian, I always say, well, what kind of learning are we talking about here? What is this learning turn that happens in the mid-1980s? Well, if you go prior to the 1980s, the learning that's being talked about, Alan Turing talked about the learning of children. In his 1950 paper on computer intelligence, machine intelligence, he talked about children learning. And that was the analogy he wanted to use to explain how machines could be intelligent. But typically, in histories of AI, it's described as psychosocial learning or geopolitical learning. It's the learning of a society. It's learning from experience. That's what's stressed. And this has generated, I'm so proud to say, what I would describe as the Tom Clancy School of History Writing. And I really encourage you to get into this. Histories of hackers, histories of cyber attacks. If you are feeling a little worried about your personal data right now, I would not recommend reading any of these books because you will not be comforted by any of them, okay? None of them will comfort you. And I realise that there are now more and more cyber attacks every day. But if you want to learn more about the history of computer security, there are bunches of books on that. Everything from, you know, lowly academics like me who discover people hacking their systems and they go on two-year journeys to figure out who they are, through to state-on-state action. And one of them really lovely, you know, this is how they tell me the world ends, looking at how the tariff wars were on the front end, but the cyber wars are in the back end. So whatever's going on right now, you can bet your bottom dollar that there's a pretty active cyber sphere. And we know that in our own community that there's more and more concern about cyber. So it's quite reasonable that there's lots and lots of books on this topic. So here we go. We're learning from experience. That experience is not necessarily children. It's psychosocial. It's about individual psychology and how people learn, whether that's good learning or nefarious learning. But there is another way of thinking about learning. And this way of thinking about learning actually gets us to think about AI in a new way and to think about it perhaps in a way that might be more promising for Australia, in ways that we can all contribute and in ways that might take it in new development directions. And that is, and this is my argument, actually what we're talking about when we're talking about learning from experience is we're learning from the past. And I'm going to explain this to two examples. So the key ways in which AI learns from the past are things like neural nets and machine learning, and I'm going to explain through an example in just a moment. But fundamentally, what happens in the mid-80s is that you get this development of what are called kind of recursive loops, the reprocessing and processing of information to identify patterns and anomalies. So rather than writing the instructions up front and executing them, actually looking at examples of things, recursively looking at them, looking for patterns and looking for anomalies. That's machine learning, right? That's learning from the past. How is that so? Let's look at the example of writing a history. So you can ask generative AI to give you instructions on how to write a history. Now, this is not a strange thing because if you've ever taught history before, you will, of course, given or you've been a student of history, you will have got instructions on how to do an assignment. You might have been given a rubric. You're going to get a really good grade if you do this, this, and this. You'll get a pass if you do this and this and this. Put yourself in the position of a student who's never, ever written a history essay before. That's quite a common experience. Not all of us have the benefit of people around us who know what those things are. You go to school and you're told to write 700 words or 1,000 words on history, and you don't know what that is. You're given a thing called a rubric, and the rubric says, well, you need to have some questions. You need to have some sources. You need to have structure. You need to revise your writing. You need to have an argument. And the student says, I don't know what those things are. Okay? Well, a machine's in the same position. So just imagine if I get that rubric and I treat each of those things as individual things. So I go out and collect some sources, and then I go out and write some questions, and I go out and write some English, and I just plop them all down on the paper. If I hand that in, you're going to fail me because I don't know what I'm doing. I've treated each of those things as separate elements. Or I might treat them as sequential elements. I might think I need to do the sources first. I'll describe those first. I'll answer the question next. I'll think of an argument next. I'll ask a question in the final paragraph. I'm still not going to do very well. But if I keep going and you keep giving me feedback, I'm going to get better. You've given me some instructions, and I've learned from the experience of your feedback over time how to get better. Now, most of us have seen some kind of history when we come into a history classroom, but consider this. Most of the people we teach history to connect with history in visual forms. Films, streaming, downloading, that's history for most people. And now go into a classroom and be asked to write an extended essay on history, that's not how you've encountered history. It's going to be challenging for you. You're going to need feedback to get there. And so over time, it's not the case that you would do it separately or do it sequentially. You're going to figure out that you need to bundle those things together coherently to write a history essay. You're going to learn from your mistakes. Hopefully you'll read the feedback and you'll get better over time if you do, okay? Machines are no different. In back propagation, they make a lot of mistakes. They get feedback. They do it again. They make slightly fewer mistakes. They do it again. They make fewer mistakes. That's how neural nets work. It's progressively trying to write a history essay and getting slightly better at it as you go, right? Now, in order to speed that process up, there's two things that are going to really help you. The first is a really fast set of computer chips. So we have these parallel processing computer chips that allow you to run lots of calculations at the same time. But the thing that I think is the clincher is that you are often learning from data from the past. So think about this. It's a lot easier to learn how to write a history or make a history if you've actually seen one before. Right? So if you've seen examples of histories, you're going to get hold of that task a bit quicker. And that's often why we set readings, because we want students to see what they actually look like. They're kind of like training sets or data archives to teach people what a history is. So I could ask students to go and write an essay, give them some readings. They actually do get a sense of what a history looks like. Now, a machine does that too. They go out and they look. Now, legally or illegally, they will scan for data. And in training these machines, you have to be very, very careful what you train them on, because you could, for instance, conclude if you're given a very tiny set of things that all 800-page books are histories. That can happen. If you read 800-page after 800-page, you say that history is 800 pages long. It's not about the past. It's just 800 pages long. So you have to train people and say it's not just how many pages it's got. And no, it's not having 1,000 footnotes. But often people think that, right? Oh, it's got to have 1,000 footnotes. And you say, but it's actually got to be on the past. It's got to be focused on that too. The other thing that can go wrong is that you can overfit. With your training set, you could, for instance, say only 800-page books on World War II are histories, right? So either of those things can happen with training sets. They happen with humans and they happen with machines. And sometimes they actually happen with television channels as well. Particularly the second one, only programs on World War II. That's never happened, ever, has it? No. Okay. So in training those machines, you do need data to, and the more data you have often, but often it's just really good data sets or sample sets that will make it. But these are artifacts from the past. Had you caught that? It's learning from things that have been made in the past, evidence or artifacts from the past. Isn't that interesting? We've gone from telling a machine what to do in future to actually taking artifacts from the past, scanning them for patterns and anomalies and making sense of them and making recommendations. So you could do this with history books. And if you go and look at some history books and some bookselling platforms, you will find, for instance, some of them are now displaying the sentences and paragraphs that ebook readers have been highlighting. If you're a really smart bookseller, you'll look at all those highlights and you'll go, ooh, all the best history books are 800 pages long and they're all on World War II and they all open this way. That's what can happen. That's where you go from learning from the past to making a recommendation. You shift from the past to the future. The training sets in AI, of course, they're magnificent data archives. And who is protecting them? This is a really important question. So NIST, for instance, Special Dataset 19, which was a handwriting data set, which was used to train post offices in how to sort letters. That's a really significant archive. There's also WordNet, a massive archive of languages use, showing people how languages are used, not grammar, but how it's actually used. And then one of the most famous ones, which is ImageNet, which is just millions and millions of pictures of things that have been labelled, including things from your phone that have been labelled. Early on, these things were labelled by humans, but now you can actually train machines to label things, and they're getting better and better. So can you see in this one slide, I've shifted from talking about instructing things to do things to saying, actually, to get there faster, you need a good chip, you need processing power, but you also can get there faster if you look at actual examples of things from the past. That's learning from experience, sure, but that's actually learning from data and archives and history. That's what it is. And the very making of those patterns or the identification of those patterns, that's history making. You might not think of it as beautiful history making like humans do, but somebody is taking data from the past and doing something with it and making a recommendation or an argument about it. That doesn't mean that I'm suggesting that a machine join history councils or publish in journals. I'm not arguing that. But arguably, the majority of the histories that are being made in the world now are not made by humans. They're actually made by machines. And they're made by you. Because I've just given you some examples of data that's been curated in archives or data that people have published in books. But the majority of the data for AI is from your past. The photos that you take, all those squiggly letters that you retype in that you've used to train algorithms to read books from the past, all the navigation routes that you've taken, all the times you spelt the same word wrong over and over and over again and been politely corrected, every traffic light that you've clicked on, every book that you've bought, every cookie that you've accepted without the sweet, sweet taste of choc chip, your actual login address, and your hand movements, which are no longer used for traffic lights. There are now these little Cloudflare turnstiles that allow you to get access just on the basis of how you've moved your hands, the content you've generated, the kitten videos you've watched, the songs you've listened to, and, of course, the movies that you've streamed. AI is making recommendations about the future on the basis of your past. All the things that you are contributing, all the clicks that you've made. And interestingly enough for me, it is kind of the age not of the eye, but at the age of hands, because our clicks, our mouse movements, our browser movements are being used not just to recommend movies to us, but to keep us safe in cybersecurity, because nobody moves a mouse like you do.
Learning about how machines learn with historian and philosopher Marnie Hughes-Warrington from the University of Adelaide. She's on Big Ideas on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen with me, Natasha Mitchell. And this is an annual lecture from the History Council of Victoria asking whether AI could be considered as a new breed of historian.
So we're beginning to see that the past is in there. And people kind of get that and they go, sure, I can see what you're arguing. It's about the data. The data's coming from the past. It's archives. I totally get it. Some of it's older than 30 years old. I'm onto that. And, you know, Let's be honest, there's a lot of literature on AI being biased. Yes, absolutely rightly so. But tell me an historian that hasn't had to deal with bias in data. That's part of what a historian does. They acknowledge the limitations of the data sets they have and they figure out how to do something good with it. That's incredible expertise that can assist AI in thinking about data. Historians are also pretty fabulous in thinking about the use and retention of data and what you do with it, making sure that people who, for instance, have experienced injustice in the past, that that injustice is not encoded in AI and leads to people missing out on loans, access to education, to emergency departments, to a whole range of things that could be so easily automated if we didn't stop and think about how we could do it well. But it's not just about data and it's not just about outputs. History runs through the AI ecosystem and it runs through what it's called its value chain. All of the activities that AI businesses engage in, history's in there. So for instance, the hardware, the chips that we use, can be better or worse in processing recursive data. If they're not good at it, they're not going to do as good a job in processing that data from the past. We talked about data. The algorithms are critical. Another way of thinking of algorithms is a form of historical or temporal reasoning, or heuristics, these rules of thumb that we use to make sense of data from the past, and the output formats. So I'm going to give you an example of how AI does something at the moment and how historians do it and what could be different. So, an example. Have you ever noticed when you go to generative AI and you type something in and it comes back with an answer and it's really upbeat and it says, I hope that's been helpful for you. I've given you this. Can I help you in any other way? It's so polite, isn't it? It's really delightful. Have you noticed that it uses the word I, which is really nice, and it asks, can I help you? That's called advisability, and that seemed to be a good friendliness action. If I ask a question at the end, you're less likely to have a go at me. And historians have been doing that for a couple of thousand years, by the way. They tend to end their books with questions, which is, please don't go at me, I'm just asking some nice questions. But AI also used the word I, which is really nice. But one thing that generative AI doesn't do is it tends not to use the words if, possible, maybe, might, could, should, would. And it doesn't say it is possibly the case, it might be the case, it should be the case, which is the very bread and butter of historians. They're saying those things to remind you the data is incomplete, it's biased. The picture's not complete. Things could change over time. The way historians use language reminds people that the work is ongoing, but AI doesn't in Gen AI. Now, research that's been published this year in Nature Communications shows that actually people like it when AI doesn't say might, could be, possibly, should. They just want the answer, and they like the word I, and they like the question. And so the more confident and polite generative AI is, the more people prefer it to humans communicating with them. Oh dear, where do we stand on that? Well, importantly, to get to that result, there's a whole lot of probabilities and uncertainties that sit behind the scenes in AI. So that confidence that comes out at the end actually belies a lot of uncertainty. Rules of thumb, they're pretty good. They're really good heuristics, great mathematical calculations, excellent work, but not 100%, never 100%, but the never 100% is not communicated. And those rules of thumb are not all human. I'm particularly interested in how insects, for instance, have inspired a lot of AI algorithms. And so the next time you do a library search or you get a summary of your own document or you go shopping, it's possible that you have ants and bees to thank. So it's not even the case that we have humans as responsible for what we're seeing now. A lot of people have been inspired by insects, by biological processes. So those processes are not perfect. They're just great rules of thumb, but they're not communicated to the user. Whereas historians do communicate that in lots of different ways. They use the word if a lot, an awful lot. They don't use the word I except in their acknowledgements pages. And how do I know this? Well, I've been looking at prize-winning histories for the last 5 years and checking what ifs and buts do people use. Do they use I? Do they ask questions at the end? Yes, they do. Historians tend to use more questions at the end of their books rather than the start. If they write journal articles, they put them in the title of their articles. And those questions are not just inviting readers to get involved in the topic, it's a way of diffusing conflict, right? Being polite to the user. Historians figured out a long time ago, like Herodotus, there's this and there's this, I can't decide between the two of them. That's a way of communicating with the audience to diffuse the notion that I might have got it all right and you disagree with me. There's some really clever things that historians do to build up a picture that actually it's not perfect, but it's really good. It's got credence. You should believe me. And that's not just the 1,000 footnotes up the back, okay? The other thing that I love that historians do is a form of kind of echolocation. So when you open historians' books and you look at the dates that they use, you're all laughing at this point because you go, oh, I feel seen. You should. That's what a theorist of history does. We look at historians. I never get invited to lunch. People get really, really worried. And I'm going to say, oh, I've read your book and I saw this and I saw this. One of the things I love about historians, the way they open books or articles, they'll often shuttle backwards and forwards in dates. It's really interesting. It's very rapid, backward and forward movement that a lot of historians do. It's so rapid that you probably haven't even noticed it. It's kind of like cinematic flicker. But what people are doing is testing the boundaries of the context for their writing, putting it out there, locating it there, locating it there, locating it there, in the way only the very best robotic vacuum cleaner could operate. No. Historians are not robotic vacuum cleaners, and nor are they ants. They've been doing this for 2,500 years and producing books that are not delivered live. They're artifacts. And you don't know who that historian is unless you've actually met them. Most of the time you take on trust that it's written by a person and they use a whole way of communicating with you, flickering in dates, asking questions, using if, to build your trust, to show you that what they've done has credence. It's highly sophisticated and it's beautiful. But for the average user of AI, it might not be where they are. Cast your mind back to what I said about the average person who connects with history. They're not reading history, they're watching it. But film itself also uses a whole range of techniques to communicate uncertainty. Flash forwards, flashbacks, people wearing wristwatches while they're wearing Roman outfits, people who have modern hairstyles and yet historic costumes. There's all kinds of ways. A love triangle in a film on Pearl Harbor. There's all kinds of ways in which these things are communicated to audiences where there's a bit of uncertainty or they know that it's actually being made in the present. And that takes me back to that notion of the users of AI. For if you've ever read anything about the history of cinema, and I love cinema, Tom Gunning said, I'm not sure that people ran away from the train when it was first put on the screen. He asked a really important question. Maybe they were in on the act because they had been to shows and they'd participated in a whole other range of spectacles prior to that point. And this is forgotten in histories of AI. If you think that AI is completely different to everything we've seen, it can generate anxiety and terror. But what if I said to you it's just a new form of history making with a 2,500-year written tradition and a 60,000-year oral tradition? You'd view it a little differently. You might feel that the ground was a little bit more solid in talking about it. You might feel that you've got a bit more to grasp hold of, and you might be able to make more sense of what's going on. That's not suggesting that you have to learn to code or mathematics. It's good if you can. But my sense is the way AI is moving is that maybe more and more will be in natural language anyway. So it's moving in our direction. The important thing about that technology example is, though, that perhaps this is our moment to think about how we transpose that if, that may be that question mark into more visual forms. And that's the work I'm doing at the moment. How could you communicate uncertainty to the users of AI about historical topics in visual forms so that they get what we're talking about? It's not dumbing down. That's maybe connecting the textual world with the visual world in a little bit more of a way and getting our users to help us. And I don't accept that Australia is simply a nation of aeroplane mode downloaders. I don't accept that. So I'm going to pose a question at the end of this lecture for all of you. Why would I take you on this journey in talking about AI in this way, apart from bringing you up to date and maybe making you more anxious or alleviating some of your anxiety? Why would I do this? Because I think this really matters for two reasons. I think it matters personally. I want us to imagine a world in which people have the right to know what histories are made about them. That seems like a reasonable right. If you engage in historical research with living subjects, you have to get their permission to do that. You ask them, and then you can offer to show them the outcome. But every time you click something, accept something, or move your hands, histories are made about you. Maybe people have the right to know about those histories. And maybe, just maybe, they have the right to contribute to making them better. Because they might have found themselves in a classroom where they didn't know what a history was or a rubric was. They may come from a group that has traditionally not made histories, but been the recipient of them. And it's not a right that belongs to the young. I actually believe that everybody has the right to know about the histories. Older Australians, people like me, younger Australians, we all have the right to know what's being done with our data. And that's not just a cyber and a security thing. I want to know what people are saying about me so that if I'm denied a loan or I don't get health treatment or I don't get a favourable credit rating, I know why and I have the ability to do something about it. But if I don't know, I can't do anything about it. In this world, every cookie that you've created is a little history. Every time you've signed on to something, a little bit of your identity has been left in the digital sphere. Since computers were networked in the mid-1980s and software got big and modular, you've been giving your credentials over and over again. And so little bits of you exist in the digital sphere. And you might have 30 plus years of you in the digital sphere. That's old enough to be history, isn't it? Or it might be what you did in the last 5 minutes when you decided my lecture was terrifying you and you started scrolling the news site. Again, your hand movements are being captured. Not always retained, not always looked after, but these are your histories, your cookies, your listening history, your terrible slideshows about waterfalls with country and Western music. These are your histories. If that's the history you want, that's great. But maybe like me, you want better. So it matters because it matters for individuals. Because at the moment, we have the right to know what our histories are under the traditional notion of history. But AI as history maker also has to do this. And I think it's important because consumers are more and more reticent to give their data. We know that the EU has risen quite powerfully and strongly in this place and regulated the use of data. And for instance, some technologies are not able to be used in Europe because people do not want their data tracked for strong historical reasons. That is the case. That regulation has been popular. It's adopted mostly in the US and it's adopted in Australia too. Think carefully about our own history of data. Think about our relationship with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and tell me that our history of data is a good one. It makes us think that we too maybe have to have a reckoning about knowing our data. So that it matters on an individual level, on an ethical level. But it also matters on the biggest scale too. because at the moment Australia is actually not in the histories of AI, apart from a couple of authors who are fabulous writing histories of AI. We're not there. Check the index, we don't really much appear. Some individuals do. We have contributed, but we're not the big story, because the big story at the moment is about how AI is reshaping our geopolitical relationships with one another. So Anu Bradford's Digital Empires, arguing that you've got the alliance between the EU and the US against state-sponsored AI in China, and how those two are in a battleground, she says, for liberalism. In my world, it's actually a battleground for history. History is diagnostic of what's going on in those spaces. If you type into some generative AI tools about some topics, you'll get some answers. You type into others, you get a different answer. We are at the forefront of geopolitical battles, and we always have been. If you read Breakneck by Wang, he talks about the differences between loyalist societies and engineering societies, and that actually neither is perfect. I don't think Australia is either of those things. It's not hell-bent on infrastructure at all costs, and nor is it litigating everything that it wants to do. Karen Ho's history of open AI and the battles in the boardroom. Do we see ourselves there? Not necessarily. And how it is people engage in tariff wars and then engage in digital wars. So these big global histories of AI are being written. And the problem is, because we're not a superpower, we don't feature. And because we don't know our histories, and we feel like we're kind of behind the ball, you can see why people feel anxious in Australia about AI. We might not feel that we have the capability to drive innovation in AI, but the truth is we can. Because it doesn't matter how late you are, you can get there if you think different. And it is the case in Australia that we are going to need to think different. And that starts with thinking about AI in ways that are more inclusive of all of us, explaining it in ways that people understand, they see the importance and know why cybersecurity matters. They know how data is archived, they know what histories are made about them, and they figure out that they can be part of the making of better histories. I truly believe that Australia as a middle power can take a different path, but it has to begin to talk about AI and to understand it differently. It can no longer be thought about as a narrow technical field, because in my experience of business, translation and commercialisation, technical ideas don't make businesses fly. People accepting them, using them, marketing them, managing them, that's what makes a business succeed. AI is much more than algorithms. It's a group of businesses, it's ways of thinking about things, and it's consumer and person acceptance. It's critical. So our mission in Australia, our goal, is to see it differently. If we are going to be a leader in AI in any way, we can be a leader in responsible AI, and we can do that by diversifying AI expertise. We can begin to make sure that everybody feels part of it, they understand it in ways that make sense, and they contribute to it being difficult. In my world, the future of AI really turns on the past, because fundamentally, AI is an historical discipline. Thank you.
Offering a hopeful vision and leaning into the future of artificial intelligence, historian, philosopher, distinguished professor at the University of Adelaide, Marnie Hughes-Warrington, with her lecture for the History Council of Victoria on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas with me, Natasha Mitchell. Now, from Holocaust histories to digital ghosts, how is AI already shaping history and the work of historians? This event at the State Library of Victoria in Naarm, Melbourne. Marnie takes some questions now from the audience.
Thank you. That was very refreshing. My name is Craig Bellamy. I work as a learning specialist at La Trobe, and I'm also a lapsed historian. And I've worked in the sort of digital humanities area for most of my career. But the question I have is, you know, about the practice of history, like how do you do history with AI? So I'm thinking, you know, things maybe around agents where you could put in lots of historical sources and get insights or whatever from those sources that you couldn't do manually or in a different way, or perhaps small language models that could be trained specifically for historians or a particular historiography or something like that. Do you know any work in that sort of area?
Yeah, actually, there's some really good papers that are now coming out. So there's a fantastic one just come out in Rethinking History on actually how Gen AI generates Holocaust testimonies and then compares those to Holocaust testimonies. Some really quite important work there, because we can't pretend that people won't use it for that. So thinking through with students, there's a really lovely moment where a survivor is describing accepting a beating and being praised for it. And the historian's a great paper, he notes and says the Gen AI just doesn't acknowledge that at all, the complexity of being in a system where you're praised for accepting something and that stereotype of, you know, just willfully accepting your own murder. It's such a powerful thing to contend with. So there's some really lovely papers that are coming out. I do want to encourage you, though, to not just stick with Gen AI. Deb Lee Talbot's done some great work on avatars. So just to freak you out, there are now companies where you can actually generate, generate avatars of your dead loved ones so that you can connect with them every day and they can ask you if you've done your homework and do all of these things. I'm writing about this at the moment and I've said I'm frankly surprised nobody's got a business model for pets that have passed, because, you know, that's a big opportunity for anybody here tonight. If you want to run a business, that's a great one. But people are making avatars. Vincent van Gogh, the exhibition, you could actually chat with Vincent in his exhibition, which was really, really interesting. The Indian Prime Minister's Museum has now got an avatar of one of their prime ministers, so you can actually chat with as well. So chatbots are actually really interesting. Patrick Stokes calls them digital ghosts. So you can do some work with students on whether they think that's right or not right. But actually, I also work with platforms that are really ubiquitous for people. So navigation apps, music streaming apps. My view is one of the best ways we can connect with students, actually ask them what apps they're actually using and look through those apps, how they handle data and how they work with data from the past. That's often the way in which I will discuss it with students, and they really do get it. They're really interested in how recommendation platforms recommend movies to them, how that actually works, how, you know, Gen AI they're interested in, but they might be just as interested in social media platforms, how they make timelines, how they don't make timelines. So my answer is always ask your students where they're connecting and which forms of history they're seeing or watching, and I would take the teaching in AI in those spaces. I've also used GitHub and Kaggle, so some of the development platforms, you can take students in there and show them what projects people are actually doing. In my world, there's lots of artifacts out there that you can work with, and ones that are hopefully free. Trove is also a brilliant one that the Australian government, of course, supports, where you can go and look up newspaper articles about the address that you live in. You know, then how could you use that to make a recommendation system? Students have got some really powerful resources they can work with. But yeah, avatars is often the one they get really interested in. We have a number of avatars that we've developed in our university to help students practice, for instance, talking to people before they go out on practicum. And it's really interesting watching their patterns of interaction with digital avatars versus humans to see what they do. Other questions?
Thanks for your talk. Derek Reed, I'm historian by training, archivist by practice, and certainly been archivist in the local government sphere, and certainly interested in looking at the role that AI could play in records management. I'm just sort of wondering if you've got any thoughts on that.
AI and records management, that's actually a beautiful thing coming together, to be honest with you, especially in local government. If you think about, for instance, the estate deeds, so let's just take the blueprints or the plans that you've got for all the properties that you've got across your local area. People are often interested in doing searches on those so that they can locate properties of particular qualities and things like that. So, yes, and I can think immediately. I know that some local areas are using navigational tools from space photographs. I received a letter this year to say that my property has a 26% tree coverage for a target of 30%. So that's my local area using aerial photography and AI to recommend that I need to plant more trees. So I've seen a whole range of applications. The big concern I've got is that a lot of local areas might not feel that they actually have the financial resources to do the digitization and also to use these tools. And it's tempting, therefore, for particularly Australian communities to sell their data offshore. This is really important. These are our assets. These are kind of what works of art. Would we sell, you know, for instance, our DNA history, our archival history, should we be offshoring that? No. Our movies, our creative works, should we be doing that? And that's often what happens when local areas don't have the money to do that. It's a real concern of mine that decisions can be made locally out of essentially poverty because people don't recognise the value of the data.
Can I ask you a question?
Of course you can, Peter.
There was a program on ABC Radio during the week which was discussing AI and the classroom, and almost all of the questions and comments were of people who thought the locomotive was coming at them. I mean, there were people in despair about what this would mean for the authenticity of student work. And that was the dominant theme of an hour of discussion, that this was a catastrophe for the world of learning and for the ability of teachers to play a positive role in evaluating student work. What would you have said if you'd been on the radio?
Well, I'm sure people said the same thing about spell checkers 20 years ago. And also probably people said similar things when radio was invented, when books were printed and people started getting information in different ways. There probably was a lot of concern about that change in communication. We are in a moment where people are genuinely concerned. Can I tell that this is this person's work versus this other person's work? We are really in that moment. We will get through that moment. But that's part of it. You know, I just told you about technologies producing results where you can't see the ifs and buts and maybes. That's part of it, is us insisting as users of these platforms that they do get better at the uncertainty. But also we do know, for instance, like there's a great firm in Adelaide called Rising Sun. They do a lot of the special effects for the Marvel movies and lots of movies. They're also interested in deepfake research. So identifying the kind of code layers to show where things have come from. And that's incredibly important work when you have, for instance, you know, deepfakes of sexual photos of school students, or, you know, is recently the case, tragically and really horrifyingly, a picture of a missing child. You know, really, we do need to actually work through these moments and say, would we accept that in print? No, we wouldn't. So we do need to work on the ethics space of this, and that's not just telling people what's wrong. How do we build that into the technologies? I think consumers are more and more, Peter, saying, I don't quite like that. And that anxiety should be harnessed in the form of, well, okay, what would make it better? What would actually make the better? I'm always of the view, how would we solve it? I can admire the problem, I can watch the train coming to me, or I can figure out how to do something about it, how to get people engaged in solving the problem and actually getting to the point where Australia might benefit from that. I think that would be a really good outcome.
Thank you. We'll have to end there, but I do want to, on your behalf, thank Marnie for what's been a superb lecture, so thought-provoking, so beautifully presented. Marnie, it's been an absolute treat. Thank you so much.
It's an honour. Thank you.
Carving a path towards a more efficient, a safer, a more ethical AI. Marnie Hughes-Warrington, historian, philosopher, distinguished professor at the University of Adelaide, with the 2025 annual lecture from the History Council of Victoria. Hey, next on Big Ideas, a question I know that's on many, many lips right now. Is it time to rethink Australia's relationship with the United States? Former head of the Lowy Institute, Michael Wesley. He's penned the latest quarterly essay. It's called Blind Spot, Southeast Asia and Australia's Future. That's next time on Big Ideas. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Great to have your company today. Our email address, we love hearing what you think about what you hear on the show. It is bigideas@abc.net.au. bigideas@abc.net.au. I'll catch you next time for more of those big ideas. See ya.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.